It's showtime.
Bob Kincaid, 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. With the final broadcast days of the month of January 2018. January's almost done. This is the 29th day of January 2018. This is the Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com and HeadOn.live are where we live. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And you'll note that there's no disclaimer there about until I get HeadOnRadioNetwork.com fixed. It's fixed, and that's a good thing. Took a little doing, but we finally got the domain name thing sorted out. And glory, you know, just glory freaking hallelujah. It's back. So that's, you know, that's an encouraging thing. Also, over at HeadOn.live, Brother Deacon Asa has been doing a little tweaking. Not that kind, assholes. He's found some...
Brother Deacon Asa has been doing...
Yeah, I got to turn the autoplay off because I loaded it on the production machine here. He found some nice photos of roundabout West Virginia to add to the one that was there on the... it was just there on the page, and they sort of rotate along. The one I happen to have landed on is the Fayette Station Bridge, which is about 740 feet below the and off to one side of, to the south and west of, the New River Gorge Bridge. And, yeah, that's a gorgeous photo. I've taken a photo that looks very much like that. Oh, well, but it's beautiful. It is absolutely beautiful, and it gives you an idea of what the world looks like around, you know, these here parts. So thanks, Brother Deacon Asa, for doing that. I am told that we are live and 5x5 on both the HeadOn.live stream and on the White Rose stream, which goes over to things like TuneIn Radio and whatnot. That's a good thing. So, all in all, the knock wood, cross your fingers and what, everything seems to be working at the moment. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid, and like I said, we've got just a scant few days of broadcasting left in the month of January, but we've got business we have to take care of right out of the box here, and that is to send out thanks. Over the weekend, thanks to the folks who help keep things running here, our subscribers, the people who set it and forget it, and then you know, just move on. Thank you to Susan in Massachusetts, and to our buddy Robert in Australia. Thank you very kindly to Randy in PA. Thanks to Philip in Texas. Thanks very much to Charlene in Rhode Island. Thanks to David Smitty in Florida. Thank you very, very kindly indeed. And then for today, thank you very, very much indeed to Terry up in Amherst, where they don't pronounce the H. And thanks to Karen in Ohio, where they do pronounce the H. And thanks very kindly to Kay in California, where there's no H to pronounce. So that's all we've got to do, as because we are now engaged in fundraising free radio until the end of January. Thank you very much, one and all, to everybody who helps keep this program on the air night after night, day after day, podcast after podcast, live broadcast after live broadcast. You are the true sponsors of this radio effort. So, Clarity went and had a look and just said, wow, WV. Yeah, it's, those are some beautiful, this is a beautiful place. That's one of the things that makes it such a conflicting place to live. There is stunning natural beauty here. There is a wealth of history and it's kind of a white colonial term. No, it's really a white colonial term. Prehistory. Right. And yet at the same time it and it's all that beauty that makes a person like me so just beside themselves to see it so willfully destroyed. Cause it is. And continues to be. And they're doubling down and upping the ante with this alleged sale of practically the whole state to China. I don't know how they're going to come and get it. I hope they got a really big boat or a U. No, they're going to need trucks and trains. Pipelines. That's why the pipelines. The Chinese are just going to pipeline West Virginia, and we're just going to go, kind of like a grape in the sun working on its raisin hood. But anyway, that's part, and there's something that ties into that, and this being Moran Monday, I'll get to it in a second. But I've got a question coming in from Steve in New York. I've been feeling lethargic today. You got anything for that? Well, funny you would ask, Steve, a member of the fraternity of Steve, because we do. Yes, I was just talking earlier today with the hardworking peripatetic periodontic scientists over at Horn Nutraceuticals at Horn Labs on Twitter. They brought me a little something, said, boss, they do that just because it's a joke. This'll perk you right up. It'll fix it. It's a blood tonic. It'll fix what ails you, and you'll be feeling perky throughout the day. Here, take these. The last time somebody said that, Alice wound up, 2 inches tall, and Dr. Hunter S. Thompson saw bats. But fools rush in where angels fear to tread, and I ain't got no angel wings, so I did as I was told, and I took them, and I did. I perked right up, and that's why I'm proud to tell you this evening about, that's right, Slobbery Slippery Elm, only from Horn Nutraceuticals at Horn Labs on Twitter. Slobbery Slippery Elm is a proprietary blend of only the finest Appalachian slippery elm bark, dried carefully and put into powder form and stuffed into tiny capsules by people with tiny hands who aren't Donald Trump, and bottled and sealed and sent off to you. Slobbery Slippery Elm from Horn Nutraceuticals at Horn Labs on Twitter will, in fact, cure your lethargy. It will provide let-up to your lethargy. It will gas up your gumption. And it'll just pick you up and make you feel like a new person who has had their wallet lightened by the tune of $109.31 for a 3-month supply of Slobbery Slippery Elm from Horn Nutraceuticals at Horn Labs on Twitter. You know, I never cared much for Slippery Elm, but thanks to the non-GMO, vegan, gluten-free, cruelty-free, free-range, cage-free preparation, proprietary in nature, of Slobbery Slippery Elm from Horn Nutraceuticals at Horn Labs on Twitter, I can get all the slobbery slippery elm that I could ever possibly want in any given day. And if you act now, and if you cough up that just tiny little bit of money for that 3-month supply, we will send it to you, as we always do, with a little bundle of test strips so you can find out in the privacy of your own home, when the profound embarrassment kicks in, what we already know here, that Slobbery Slippery Elm from Horn Nutraceuticals at Horn Labs on Twitter has absolutely no nutritional or medical benefit whatsoever. It is an absolute bullshit product, just like all the other bullshit products advertised on radio programs all across this country, the only difference being we tell you it's a bullshit product on the front end. Slobbery Slippery Elm from Horn Nutraceuticals at Horn Labs on Twitter. Accept no substitutes, post no bills, use no hooks, this side up, FOB, COD, SLIPPERY, ELM, Slippery Elm of the slobbery kind, only from Horn Nutraceuticals at Horn Labs on Twitter. Don't call now. Operators aren't standing by. You won't be glad you didn't. Or something. That's right. A bullshit nutritional supplement. Because you can't be a professional radio program without you got a bullshit nutritional supplement to hustle to the unsuspecting rubes who linger on the far fringe reaches of one's program and are simple enough to think that they can get a remedy that will improve their lives from some person who yaks on the radio. No, not that kind of yakking. Not the... Although, from time to time, you can get a little reflux on the Slobbery Slippery Elm capsules, and they'll probably make you do that. Otherwise, great stuff, especially if you don't take it. I'm sure you get my meaning. Well, as a matter of fact, I'm glad you asked. Jeff from Hill Hole, Indiana says, But Bob, will Slobbery Slippery Elm help give me solid wood? Well, it's made from solid wood, Jeff. What do you think? Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, Scott and Punky want to know, but Bob, does it contain twice the iron as a whole pound of calf's liver, like Ted Mack used to claim Geritol Tonic did on his commercials for it on the original Amateur Hour? Iron? Huh. It's got titanium. Iron can rust and oxidize, and you don't want any oxidizing going on inside your body. That's what you that's where your free radicals come from. And Slobbery Slippery Elm, by virtue of having no iron in it whatsoever, will not contribute to your free radical quotient inside your bloodstream. That's modern nutritional bullshit science is what that is. And we're on the cutting edge of it. Yes. So, yes, Earther wants to know. It is free of the cruelty of vegans. Well, no, it's not. Vegans happily harvest our slobbery, slippery elm for us, and they go at it with a will. They strip that slippery elm bark, and you can hear the slippery elms screaming and hollering and carrying on all the way from Frosty Bottom to Busted Knuckle. You can. You absolutely can. Meanwhile, of course, let's check in with an ongoing feature we've been working in the new year here. It's time for This Day in Horn History. That's right, for today's edition of This Day in Horn History, we're dialing the Horn 9000 time machine 5 years into the past, all the way back to January the 29th, 2013. Bob opens the Titanic Tuesday program with I Promise I Won't Sing, I Left My Heart in San Francisco, in what turns out to be a three-hour monologue with occasional audience chiming in about his first ever trip to California. We hillbillies do get excited when we get to travel outside Appalachia. Broadcasting from the ACAC headquarters in Washington, D.C., Bob's been traveling west for the last few days, away from his home, away from home. I've never been to California before, Bob explains, and I have a better understanding now why it is so magic to so many people. I'd never been to such a nice place in an otherwise ordinarily bitter, cold month. It was. I love January in San Francisco. What an awesomely functional piece of universe California is. During his trip to California, Bob gets to sail out in the bay of San Francisco, and in doing so, he says he was able to check off one of the items on his bucket list. Also, during his trip to California, Bob's had the opportunity to visit Muir Woods National Monument in Mill Valley, California, which he describes as a religious experience. I got to see the ancient redwood trees, and truly, because you know how I am with religion, right? I hadn't felt like I'd been in a sacred space or a holy place in a very, very long time. But in that moment, walking into Muir Woods to be among trees that are in excess of 1,000 years old, gracious, that feels like sacred space, more so than any pile of stones or bricks made by the hand of man. I did that on Saturday, and on Sunday I was sailing on the bay. That's two churches in 2 days. Bob's sojourn to California also included a real honest-to-goodness tree-hugging experience, about which he says people who complain about tree-huggers have never hugged a tree before. It's an amazing experience. It's cleansing. It's grounding. A hokey cell phone picture was taken of Bob's tree-hugging ritual, not because he didn't want a proper one taken with a good camera, but because the little Belgian bastard stole my camera last May. Bob quibbles, the little bastard snatched my backpack and skipped away, at which point Bob's kids, who are present in the room, start skipping around in an act of mercilessly mocking Bob. Bob's reverent recollection of his California trip reminds me of the final scene of the 90s movie in which a retired law dog leaves his home in Wichita and moves out west to make a fortune gambling. You ever see the sun come up over the Rockies? It hits all of a sudden, and below, there's California. And you swear you're looking at heaven. And that's a look into the ghost of Horn Past, 1,826 days into antiquity, all the way back to January 29th, 2013, for This Day in Horn History. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. I still remember it. Haven't been back since. Hope someday to be able to. It was magnificent. Earth are asking, and five years ago, Bob didn't visit Stephanie Miller? Doggone it. Well, you can only pack so much excitement and activity into one brief trip to the coast. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks for tickling my memory and reminding me of that. I was out there. I was out there on a sad mission. I was attending a memorial service for an ally of those of us who stand in opposition to the ongoing destruction of Appalachia. She had died in a truly bizarre accident, and that was the reason for being there. But she was one of those people who really, really enjoyed her life, and as a consequence, there were people who made a darn dedicated attempt to making sure that the people who came to her memorial enjoyed the journey as well. And of course, our buddy Tom, out in the Bay Area, was the one who took me out on his magnificent sailboat. Not a lot of wind that day, but we puttered around the bay for an hour or so, and it was a beautiful thing. It was absolutely a beautiful thing. So at 21 minutes past the hour, I guess we'd better jump into the hoopla. I'll start off by pointing out something my buddy Dr. John just sent along. I had read about it earlier in the day. And it is a cause. It's a cause for grieving. You know, last year, the Charleston Gazette Mail reeled in a Pulitzer Prize for its reporting on the opioid crisis in West Virginia. And I guess it's a good thing that they did, because they probably won't be getting any more. In the news today, an announcement that the Gazette, which pound for pound and blow by blow is without a doubt the finest newspaper in this state and one of the finest small papers I've ever read. And I'm not kidding. It is that good of a paper. It's worth me going down to the Rippey Mart every morning and shelling a little change out of my pocket just to get it. It is eminently readable, especially when compared to the other paper that one can get around here, the Beckley Register Herald, with which I would not insult the guts of a dead carp by wrapping them in it. No, the Gazette has declared bankruptcy, Chapter 11 bankruptcy. The high bidder to assume ownership of the Gazette is Wheeling Newspapers. All the employees, including some fine, fine reporters, have been given what's called a WARN notice, a Worker Adjustment and Retraining Notification Act notice. That tells employees that there will be layoffs, a potential for layoffs of more than 50 employees. 206 people work for the Gazette. I know this is, and this has happened in other. I feel a profound sense of sadness over this. Partly because I know a few people at the Gazette. I've interacted with a couple of their reporters from time to time. I've appeared in print on their pages. And it's sad. Wheeling Newspapers could decide to maintain current employment levels, but because that will remain unknown until the bankruptcy runs its course, Charleston Newspapers decided to issue the WARN notice under advice of its counsel. They'll file for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection tomorrow, and that starts a 60-day countdown clock running before new ownership could take over. In the meantime, there's a 30-day auction window when other potential buyers could step forward and try to outbid wheeling newspapers. This is sickening. It's like watching a little bit of little piece of democracy die. Because you know what? Look, I say this as a member of what is broadly referred to as electronic media. There is no replacement for print media. Well-made-up, beautiful news readers who had minors in journalism or not even journalism, majors in media studies and minors in cosmetology, and guys with perfect hair and perfectly teased out chest hair peeking over their necktie knots, will never who do news in 30-second blips and blops will never be able to touch what a newspaper does. And there have even been intimations scientifically that reading the newspaper online doesn't have the same effect. I could make an argument that because of the comments section, too many people read a newspaper story and they're waiting to get to the end because they've already formulated the little the driblet of snark that they want to post so it can be put on their Facebook page. I'm as guilty as the next guy or woman. But there's no replacing the reflection that takes place, and if there are younger people, and there are younger people than I who listen to this program, and as either the very last tail end of the boomer generation or the front end trailblazer portion of the Generation Xers, I got to watch and see what print media was all about in terms of how it affected a family. On the days when he worked what he called the day shift, my father would come home, and he loved nothing so much as, and look, we were a West Virginia family, an Appalachian family in the furthest reaches of the Appalachians, living in Northwest Alabama. And my dad would get home from the furnace. My mom would have, look, this is just America. I'm sorry. It's not a patriarchy thing, maybe it is. Maybe it all is. I don't know. Whatever. But my dad would get home from work. My mother, I would have come home from school a little bit before. My mother would be putting something together for dinner. And my dad would get home from the furnace. The air conditioner would be turned up to a setting called meat locker to make the house positively frigid because of the far end of the other side of the spectrum that he had just been through on the furnace. And he would sit down in his chair, and proceed to read the local newspaper. And it wasn't chaos. This is a man, and I think this is important. This is a man that I never saw, and I mean never, reading a book. just didn't happen. Maybe he didn't feel like, you know, a book takes a while, and, you know, you just, you read some, you put it down, you pick it up, you read some more, you put it down, you pick it up. Maybe that was just, that was too much in, I mean, maybe it was just too attenuated in his world. But he would take that newspaper, and if there was any doubt, my father was far from being an illiterate. He was somewhat coarse. He had come up in a coal mine culture. He had done a tour in the Navy in the Second World War, as you all know. Because I can't resist talking about him, because this is one way, you know, his memory is his eternity. And, you know, from the mines, the Navy, the furnace, the man could swear. He, at least in my presence, limited his swearing vocabulary, but it was quality swearing. It wasn't just words thrown out for the sake of being there. But he didn't have any problem reading. And he would take our little small town daily there that's owned by the New York Times now. This is the same newspaper that several weeks ago, months ago now, gave us that now famous, infamous headline, GOP divided over sex clams. And he would pick apart the grammatical errors. Because oddly enough, in high school, he'd had a couple of years of journalism. He knew how to write things. He knew how to express himself. But he didn't spend a lot of time doing it. But he could read and absorb and process and analyze. And after dinner, as I've said before, my mother and father would pass the newspaper sections back and forth to each other, giggling. My mother having been the high school editor of her newspaper, giggling at the freshman mistakes that would be made in putting that newspaper out. You know, the misplaced modifier type stuff, like man killed by car crossing the street. And throw me down the stairs my hat and throw mother from the train a kiss. That sort of thing. And that's where I get my love of that stuff from. But he had a love for his evening newspaper. And he would devour it. If he wasn't working the day shift, if it was the 4 to 12 or the midnight shift, he would still read the paper whenever it was that he either got done or got up. It was either the first thing or the last thing he did, reading his newspaper. And he never treated as being anything resembling serious the so-called news that was being conveyed across the television. And that was a big part of the extent to which this country had an informed citizenry. Because my father was an everyman. He was passionately dedicated to the proposition that no man on earth was any better than him for simply being here. There were people who were wealthier. There were people who were smarter. There were people who were simply different. But he was not one to bow a knee or kiss a ring. And I was imbued with that same sense. My father was the kind of man who would have stood toe-to-toe and eye-to-eye with the monarch of a country or the Pope and looked them in the eye and shook their hand with a good, firm American handshake. And I think that's a good way to go about being an American. Wheeling newspapers, Ogden newspapers out of Utah. I have no confidence whatsoever that the tenaciously independent approach that the Gazette has taken to the ongoing dismantling and sale by the ton of this state will be honored by any successor in interest. I'm grieved by this. I'm sad at this. There is a sense of something lost. Apparently, Wheeling Newspapers is the high bidder at the moment, but the thinking goes that Ogden Newspapers may very well outbid them. And so one more thing, and not just one more thing, perhaps the most precious thing this state has will be taken from us. And there's the first comment. If you scroll down, the little trolls,
perhaps the Charleston Gazette Mail should have been objective in reporting the news.
See, that's how it is with fucking Trumpanzees. Oops, I was trying to do this without using any fun words. That one snuck in. Sorry. But that's how it is with the maggots. You should only print news that they approve of. This is a sad day. Sadder still when some right-wing newspaper consortium gets hold of it. It just feels like everything we have in Appalachia is marked for liquidation. Just sad, sad, sad. And yet, oddly enough, over the course of the weekend, the Charleston Gazette, and it will always be the Gazette to me, not the Gazette Mail, the Charleston Daily Mail was the right-wing rag, the with all due respect to Punky and other avian members of the Horn Family Community Congregation, the Charleston Daily Mail was the state birdcage liner. I did what I do. I read the paper on Saturday. And then I read the paper on Sunday. And there was a story tucked away by a fine reporter by the name of Rick Steelhammer. And I had it in the stack for this evening simply because there's not a blessed thing there's not a blessed thing involving the Nectarine Nero in this story. And so, given the fact that that all the other radio programs are wall-to-wall Trump. Sometimes I like to remind myself that there is a world beyond the Mar-a-Lago Mussolini. That things happen on a day-to-day basis. That he doesn't impact and doesn't impact him. I'm sure we'll find our way into conversation about some trivial or not so trivial aspect of his ongoing disaster presidency, but this story doesn't. And just because of who I am and how I am and what interests me and things I've studied, when I saw this headline, I clicked. Headline, FBI, bones found at Kanawha Falls, not those of cold case murder victim. You'd click that, wouldn't you? Well, having read it in the hard copy, I went and clicked it. Because I wanted to save it for this evening. Once upon a time, people who did this kind of work would fastidiously clip out newspaper stories and maybe using a glue stick, glue it to another piece of paper, and they'd have them all literally in a stack. That's why we refer to the stack. But for the most part, the stack is a bunch of open tabs on a browser now. I don't work with paper. Cuts down on the rattle on the rattling around the microphone factor. Rick Steelhammer writes, human bones found in December 2016, initially suspected to be those of a woman believed to have been abducted and killed in 1979, have turned out to be the remains of three people, most likely Native Americans, according to an FBI analysis. A Fayetteville man searching for, and see, this is part of one of those things that runs up a tree. A Fayetteville man searching for Native artifacts, because that's a thing, across the Kanawha River from Glen Ferris near the Riverwide Waterfall. Okay, so for geography's sake, the Gauley River meets the New River, and they merge to form the Great Kanawha River, which is one of those greater than the sum of its parts kind of streams. And then there's a falls, which were leveraged by early industry around here to create electrical power to run the furnaces that my father would eventually work on. Well, there's Glen Ferris on the one side. That's the side that the main road runs by. And then across the river, which is pretty broad at that point, there's hillside and railroad track and, you know, small road. And some guy from Fayetteville was scrabbling around, and he wandered up to a rock overhang. We have a lot of those. Being as how we're in Appalachia, and in Appalachia is mountains. And curiously enough, the people who lived here for millennia before white folks arrived, and everybody else, not arrived, but brought here in many cases, used those rock shelters, those overhangs, as pretty convenient places to go about the business of living their lives. So our pot hunter here, our arrowhead collector, runs across human bones under a rock shelter, but he doesn't put two and two together and say to himself, I betcha this is an ancient habitation site. No, the thing that pops into his mind is, I better call the cops. Now, this is a skull. It's not like there's any flesh or hair or eyeballs or No, it's just, it's bare, naked bone. And he runs off and tells the cops. The cops then show up, and they paint bright orange arrows and circles and on boulders and trees and whatnot to point the way to the rock shelter so the investigators can find it. Yeah, I'm still at kind of a loss why our pot-hunting, arrowhead-scrabbling friend couldn't have simply taken the cops there. But they come in, and they then collect the bones. And they look at them for a little while and scratch themselves in various places. And then they send it off to the FBI, the bones. And the FBI sits around and scratches themselves and looks at each other curiously. Because the whole question is whether the bones were the remains of a woman who disappeared in February 1979, by the name of Susan Roop. As Rick Steelhammer writes, the remains were taken to the medical examiner's forensic laboratory in Charleston and later to the FBI's forensic lab in Quantico, Virginia. The FBI is, of course, an arm of the federal government. So the bones were put into the possession of the federal government. Mr. Steelhammer continues, while an early inspection of the bones indicated that they were only 30 to 40 years old, the FBI analysis determined that the remains were in fact ancient and came from three individuals, none of whom was Susan Roop, the suspected homicide victim missing since February 1979. Fayette County Sheriff Mike Fridley and prosecuting attorney Larry Hara announced the FBI's findings earlier this month. A report on the origin of the bones was recently released to Fayette County authorities, concluding that, quote, the remains are not those of Ms. Roop, and the ancient remains contain the bones of three people. The statement quotes the FBI report indicating the remains are ancient, and then the press statement goes on to say, bones may be a couple of hundred years old. Couple of hundred years old. Upon inquiry, reporter Steelhammer was able to determine via Fayette County Sheriff's Deputy Detective Kevin Willis that the FBI lab didn't bother to do any carbon dating. They just figured out that it wasn't Susan Roop's bones, and then, oh well. Detective Willis, and with a statement like this, you can understand how he rose through the ranks to become Detective Willis, said, we can assume that the bones are Indian in origin, quote, since the area was predominantly Native American in that time frame. Which time frame? You didn't do any carbon dating or DNA analysis. Couple of hundred year old. You know, because about 300 years the Indians got here, and they was here a couple of hundred year ago, and then the white folks arrived, and now there ain't no Indians. At least, there's no recognized Indian. There is not a single recognized Indian tribe in the state of West Virginia because they were, well, sort of genocided right out of here. But there's reason to believe that those bones are probably more than a couple of hundred year old. It might even be a couple of thousand year old. Because there's pre-existing evidence of a pretty vibrant woodland culture. There's one culture identified in the literature as the Fort Ancient culture. And yeah, they were here a lot more than a couple of hundred year ago. Unless by a couple of hundred year ago you mean 1,000 years ago. And they had a predilection for living along rivers. Because, you see, back before the coal industry began pouring filth in the rivers were full of these things called fish. Lots and lots of these things called fish that a culture could eat and have a pretty doggone high protein content in their diet. And the woods, back before we started blowing the mountains up and drilling them through full of holes and poisoning every stream that dribbled out of the hollers, there are these things called deer. And they make pretty good eating. Apologies to the vegans out there. But they do. And there are these things called bears. And if you had the nerve to go after one, well, their hides made, as did the deer hides, but particularly the bear hides, they made really, really good clothing for surviving Appalachian winters. And the bones could be used to make really quite effective tools, punches and needles for sewing things like bear hides and so forth. And well, there were possums and all kinds of edible creatures. Because yes, I realize that it's dismaying, but the people who lived here first ate a lot of the local flora and fauna. And you know, once upon a time, hell, there were elk here. We've recently tried to introduce some elk onto a mountain, former mountaintop removal site. I expect they'll die off pretty quick. That or they'll be poached by the hunters going, hey, we got us a, that's a big-ass deer. And there were even buffalo. No, really. The Appalachian... the Appalachian Mountains had buffalo wandering around in them. And in fact, the what's called the Midland Trail, the U.S. 60, became a federal highway at one point after first having been a pioneer trail, having previously been an Indian trail before that, that they created because they followed along after the deer and the wandering buffalo that were kind of working their way through the mountains down to the rivers and et cetera and so on. This is all the background to, yeah, them bones look like they're probably a couple hundred year old. It ain't Susan Roop, that's for damn sure. And one of the things that's particularly fascinating about all of this is that a few years back, and I've mentioned this on the program before, I think it's a lovely example of doing it right. But a few years back, they were building a parking garage down in Logan, West Virginia, when they came across a bunch of burials. And it was pretty obvious it wasn't any white folks, colonists, whatever you want to call them. And they did the DNA analysis, and they found out that the nearest living relations were the Sioux people of the Great Plains. And so the bones were repatriated to the Sioux people so that they could be properly dealt with within the traditions of the Sioux people. But there's no plans to test these bones, so we don't know if they're Sioux or Shawnee or Delaware or Seneca or Cherokee. I got some Cherokee in me. I just can't prove it. Right? Ron in Raleigh points out, hey, Bob, perhaps those bones could possibly be the remains of some of the lost tribes of Israel, as told by the Mormons. Yeah, them might have been the Nehis or the Lowbaggers or whatever it is in that silly book that was allegedly translated from Reformed Egyptian. Nematodes, I can't remember. But now, and one wonders, it's just sad. Archaeological sites are rare and fragile, and the Fayette County Sheriff's Department seems completely at ease with the idea of leaving painted arrows on rocks and boulders so that everybody and their cousin can go down there and say, hey, let's see if we can find us an engine bone. Maybe, you know what, we might be able to make a pipe out of it we could smoke dope through. Yeah, wouldn't that be cool? We could probably sell them. We could, put them on the Facebook and sell. Indian bone pipes. We'll call them peace pipes. No, it did. It made my stomach turn because, for instance, there's a rock shelter up in Pennsylvania that upon its discovery through American Native archaeology timelines into complete chaos if the theory behind the research proves true. Because there's this idea called Clovis First, and this looks like it just throws the whole Clovis theory into chaos and then out the window. And you can't know. And we're not going to know because this site is owned, who knows, a railroad company, a land company. Odds are about 99-1 against that land being owned by a single individual. And now it's just going to be wrecked if it hasn't been already. And there's not going to be anybody there to study it or to catalog it, to dig it, to go down through the layers upon layers that represent years and years and years of human habitation. Oddly enough, immediately above that site, roughly speaking, there was a mountain wherein had been documented a rather vast stone enclosure that was not built by white colonizers. It predated white arrival in this area. And if there are any similarities to be drawn, probably most similar to the similar enclosures done down in the Appalachian Hills of North Georgia. Now, understand, it just took me something on the order of 20 minutes or so, or a little bit more. And granted, I don't talk fast. To lay out all the details that surround this story. Haven't even mentioned the existence of the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, because somehow or another they figured out that it doesn't apply. So, you know, maybe they can take the bones over to the mystery hole and see the ancient Indian bones for, you know, $5 or something like that. I don't know what's going to happen. I just know that the right things are not going to happen, or there's no evidence that the right things are going to happen so far. They found out it's not Susan Roop. Who gives a shit? But it took me a good 20 minutes to a half an hour to lay out all the details of this story, granted within my own limitations and the way I do things here. You couldn't do that in a 1 minute and 28 second package on Action Eyewitness Team News Coverage 71. Thanks for that report, Bill. We'll be back with a touching story of some economically anxious coal miners who would... No, you can't. And so... the only way to really get a handle on it was to have some real live, honest to goodness newspaper reporting that gave enough details for me to at least ask the question, or questions that attend the story. Journalism matters, and I have real misgivings about calling what happens on the television journalism. My weekends are kind of strange because my mind will, my weekends are often consumed by just sort of letting my mind wander where it will. A note coming in from Steve, a member of the fraternity of Steve on the Gulf Coast. When trivia isn't trivial, papers go everywhere, get passed around, are infinitely practical. Your fingerprints are all over a good paper. They are utterly classless. A rich man reads his morning stocks. A working man reads his evening leisure. It was no accident the liberal paper always being the evening paper and oftentimes cheaper. I remember growing up getting an early Sunday paper late Saturday night, especially in the summer. People drove up even at midnight buying a copy. I thought it was cheating just a little, getting away with something and reading early news. The paper also makes a cup of coffee taste better, and it serves as a natural conversation starter, mostly in a crowded place. I've talked politics with tramps waiting for freight trains, the morning paper stuffed in their back pocket. You can't get all worked up about something important on the editorials page and leave your scribbled marginalia between the lines and leave the copy on the table for the next reader, when nobody any longer reads. You're damn right, says Steve. This loss of news print culture, the loss of the American citizen. Regards, Steve, on the Gulf Coast. It is artifactual, a newspaper. If you thumb through old books and family Bibles and the like, you'll find yellowed newspaper clippings that have somehow survived a century or more sometimes. And it will be, and you'll know that what is in your hand was important enough for a human being to have either carefully folded and then torn, or likely as not, taken the time to go and get the scissors we used on paper, not the scissors we used on cloth or for sewing, because those were the good scissors. It's another lesson. And take the time to clip it out. And if your correspondent from a century previous was particularly concerned and attentive to detail, the story will be clipped out in such a way as to provide you with the date and the newspaper in question. Even in the modern age, if you are somewhere where there are framed copies of newspapers or framed copies or framed pieces of newspaper stories, look at how people respond to them. They will go up and they will read them. And they'll pay attention to them. And they will have about them the air of something special. Tangible artifacts of times and lives gone by. Over at one of the awesome little restaurants that dot my the little community of Fayetteville. When you go to the men's room, there's a framed copy of a local newspaper, because where that restaurant sits was once the home of the local paper, you know, printing presses and the typesetting and all that shit. Ink. And as you stand there in the men's room taking a whiz, you read the news from 80 years ago. And it's irresistible. And they don't have a stock of 80-year-old pieces of newspaper that they just frame and put up. You know, some restaurants, bars and whatnot, will have a glassed-in case, again, hanging over the urinal, where they put the day's sports page. Or the front page, for that matter. Just a little something to occupy your time while you're whiling it away, emptying your bladder. Do they do that in the women's restroom? Like, you know, you close the stall door and there's the newspaper. I don't know. And we are hopefully slowly moving toward a place, a time and a place where the idea of, well, whatever, I'm not going to get into that. But I've actually seen people guys come out of the men's room and go, "Did you read the paper?" Yeah, that is so cool. That's so cool they've got that. And you get the idea that newspapers are liked things, that they're valued things, but somehow the time in which we live has taken from us that little bit of what used to be known as middle and lower class leisure, where some working stiff got to strip down to his t-shirt and his boxers, put on his house shoes, and sit in his favorite chair in a room cooled down to meat locker and read a newspaper. The day's gone. I don't know if there's any way to get it back short of some sort of Dune-like revolution in which you come up with a law that says thou shalt not make a machine in the likeness of a human mind. But it goes beyond computers. Television was damaging to print media. And it all goes to the capitalization of the leisure time of a working person. The idea as of time as commodity. And if you've got the proles sitting around reading the news and digesting it in detailed form, well, they're not going to be nearly so easy to inflame and weaponize as some aspects of our political culture would prefer. Because even if you're reading a right-wing rag, you're still reading it with the time to think about it. And if the reporting is good, you know, the right, the whatever the ideology is, will be on the opinion pages, and the news will be good old-fashioned hard reporting. I mean, you can see that, and frankly, a very good example of that is the Wall Street Journal. Their opinion page is a sewer. A typically Rupert Murdoch polluted sewer. But there's good reporting to be had on the news pages. But the Wall Street Journal cannot do the job that the Charleston Gazette does or the busted knuckle moral volcano and battle cry of freedom. It just can't any more than iHeartRadio being satellite cast out of some building in Carolina. It can address the needs of people in North Dakota where a bomb train just blew up. Meanwhile, Ron in Raleigh tells me it's a guy thing. you're just trying to. Ron simply says, "Have you ever seen a woman take reading material to the bathroom to enjoy a good read in a dump?" Well, actually, yes. But maybe we're just weird that way. Ron says, P.S., will you be lashing yourself to the mast of the SS Agnes tomorrow so I won't have to? Talking about the State of the Union. Yes, I will. But we kind of talked about this on Friday. Doesn't that start at 9? So we'll kind of be off the air. It might be Malloy who's lashed to the mast. Meanwhile, Matt in San Francisco observes, subject line, economically anxious Arby's workers. Since there are more of them, I'm going to produce a story of the economically anxious Arby's workers. Not the same hook as the coal miners, the drama of the heavy equipment and all. It would also not be pushing the stereotype of the pushed-down white, hardworking American who's being crushed by the new economy. That works. Had an Arby's worker tell me all about the roast beef one time. And don't go to Arby's very much. But we're in a time and place where weaponized media have changed the face of this nation. With the exception of the maggots and the sparkle fart powered unicorn cavalry purity brigade, most of us understand that social media was weaponized in the last election campaign, and it will be weaponized again for the 2018 congressional elections and the other elections that go with it. And I guess many of us are just happy co-opted warriors in that process. I like to think more people on our side of the debate can tell the difference between being manipulated and not, but I'm not so sure of that anymore. I wish I was. But we are, Friday, I think Friday's the 2nd, isn't it? That book, that science fiction novel that I love, Altered Carbon, premieres on Netflix. And it's premised on notions of digitized human consciousness. And I've been watching the trailers, and I don't have a good feeling about it. The vibe just looks all wrong. Withholding judgment. Maybe it'll be awesome. But it's a future world where even one's thoughts are capitalized and commoditized. And to that extent, it is a commentary actually on the present, as all great science fiction is. So, when I see that the Gazette is going the way of all flesh, I mean, they're not going to quit publishing. The capital of a given state is always going to have some sort of a newspaper, but it's that some sort of a that becomes the problem. Will it become simply a cheerleader for the extraction industry? Well, what does that newspaper group out of Ogden, Utah? What's their history? Or Wheeling newspapers? The Wheeling Post-Intelligencer is a pro-Republican garbage tip. It does not bode well. Yeah, Steve on the Gulf Coast reminds me. Transmitted via satellite. Hence USA Today instantly being transformed into McPaper. Fake news for real. Although, oddly enough, you can see some halfway decent reporting via... And you see it online. You know, I can't remember the last time I bought a USA Today. Via big truck. It's out there, but it's out there to be read online. But the essential problem, you know, and I said it goes back to radio and newspapers lived in relative harmony. Early TV did too. And like I said, I spend the weekends just letting my mind wander. And Agnes and I just spent time together on Saturday. Didn't necessarily go anywhere, didn't necessarily do anything. Sometimes working class folks just sit, and that's okay. I mean, Agnes still went and did. She always goes and she always does, and that's why my life is good. For reasons that evade understanding, she loves me, and she makes my life magnificent. But I got to chasing internet butterflies, and telling stories of my of the past, and was talking about, you know, the CNN days and everything. And we wound up watching a couple of documentaries online about Ted Turner. If I've ever had a business person be a hero of mine, and I generally don't, he comes as close as there is. Classically trained, you know, Latin and Greek. And because of such privilege as he had, he took that and went out into the world and was a different kind of mogul. But it all started with me telling Agnes about, we had cable, and this is kind of an interesting juxtaposition, at least to me, with that same scenario of my father coming home and reading the newspaper. We got cable in our hometown early on because the terrain was hilly enough and the stations were far enough away that, with the exception of a pathetic little NBC affiliate, an antenna wouldn't bring in diddly. So there was a cable company. And I guess it was around, sixth grade, seventh grade for me. Lo and behold, something completely new appeared on our cable system. And it was what was then, I mean, the name change hadn't even gone through. It was WTCG Channel 17 out of Atlanta. TCG stood for Turner Communications Group. And they had the standard FCC. You know, every now and then you'll hear some poorly informed person saying, "We got to bring back the Fairness Doctrine." Really, it's not even worth arguing with them. But we got WTCG, and they had the same public service obligations that any other TV stations had. They had to air on a daily basis a certain amount of news and or public affairs programming, and all the other TV stations put it on at, 6 o'clock. Local 6 o'clock news for us in the central time zone where God lives, the 5 o'clock news. Turner instead said, "I'm going to give people an alternative to watching the news," and instead would run Andy Griffith or Gomer Pyle or Gilligan's Island or the Munsters, God only knows, in that time slot. And did quite well. But he still had a news obligation to fulfill, so he took a young guy from Pittsburgh named Bill Tush and said, "Okay, 3 o'clock in the morning, we're going to run the news." So at 11 o'clock at night, they'd take some wire copy and just read news. And it was really not nobody gave a damn. And then they started to realize that nobody gave a damn, so they'd monkey around with it. And eventually he was reading the news next to a dog in a shirt and tie long before Rick Springfield ever had a dog in a shirt and tie on the cover of Working Class Dog. That'd be about 4 or 5 years later. And along the way, it turned into one of the most one of the edgiest, hippest little things going in broadcasting, and people were getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning. I was one of them. Sneaking out of my bedroom in a small ranch-style house in northwest Alabama, turning on the television, sitting very close to it with the volume way down so as not to disturb my parents, and sitting there and cackling, watching these hijinks. News at 3 o'clock in the morning. Eventually I got caught. And then Mom and Dad sat there and cackled with me, and we turned the volume up. They were like that. But the funny thing is, as I went on discussing it with Agnes, that idea of people not having to get their news at some set time of day, and the idea that there could be news at 3 o'clock in the morning, was the tiny little mustard seed that germinated inside Turner's brain until eventually, on June the 16th of 1980, CNN went on the air. And it was mocked. It was derided. And then it turned out they were doing journalism, as close as television can get to it. And in fact, they were doing something more closely resembling journalism than anybody could do who only had, you know, a tiny little block in the evening to deal with. And everybody cites the Gulf War as the moment when CNN grew up. But a couple of years before that, the 24-hour news cycle was invented when little baby Jessica fell down a well in Midland, Texas. Midland, Texas, home of a failed oil prospector named George W. Bush. But little baby Jessica, he wasn't on our radar. But little baby Jessica was, and for days, weeks, people tuned in around the clock to see what the latest was on the attempt to pull little baby Jessica out of the well, and would she survive? And a nation sat on the edge of its seat, and no matter where you were, if you were near a TV, you clicked over to CNN to see what was going on with little baby Jessica down the well in Midland, Texas. Because it was the only place you could get that. And if you were in a hurry, you clicked over to what had started out as CNN2 and quickly became headline news to get the snapshot of little baby Jessica down the well. And that, not the Gulf War, that was the birth of the 24-hour news cycle. And now, thanks to technology, the 24-hour news cycle has morphed into a news cycle that can scarcely even be measured in hours at all, and cannot be captured on a printed page with an information hungry world waiting to gobble up the next bite the next day. But with the manifest success of CNN, which was undeniable after Bush War I, otherwise known as the First Gulf War, Well, that's where Rupert Murdoch comes in. And he looked at it and said, well,
looks to me like if that Tanner fella can have himself a news network, we need one for us. You know, right-wingers.
And thus was born Fox News. And out of Fox News came the filth, in part, of the great cleanest hunt. Out of Fox News came the in large part the drumbeat for Bush War II. Out of Fox News came the relentless assault on Barack Obama for having the unmitigated temerity to be president and at the same time have skin darker than a grocery bag. And out of Fox News came Donald Trump. How about that? I said we were going to not do any Trump stuff, but lo and behold, son of a gun, there he is. And so with given my eye toward history, when all of this, by virtue of processing it, discussing it with Agnes, dawned on me, it's like that scene from Seinfeld where the Kenny Rogers roaster goes in next to Kramer's apartment, and he opens the door and he's physically blown back by the neon light of the Kenny Rogers chicken restaurant. It blew me back like that when I realized that a half-assed, smart-assed approach to having to fulfill a bureaucratic regulation for news and public affairs programming is actually the origin story of the civic disaster in which we now find ourselves. It stopped me in my tracks. Holy smoke. And along the way, I got to have my little tangential experience in all of that. And I have lived and observed the entire timeline of it. And it's one of those moments where you look up and say, there are no accidents. There are merely causes and effects that we do not understand at the time that they are unfolding before us. And yeah, it'll push you back in your chair. And it'll blow your mind a little bit to think of things in that kind of light. Some email. Steve in New York with a subject line, paradox. Could it be that the digitization of newspapers and other print media and its proliferation is free to read be the reason we don't value the reading of magazines and newspapers anymore? There's nothing special about reading something that comes to you in your inbox and which you can easily discard because it's free to the newsreader. Well, there's an argument to be made, Steve, that something that people attach more value to something that they have to pay for. And frankly, this little decade-plus experiment in broadcasting is an attempt to disprove that theory. I don't know if we have. I think it has more to do with the conditioned hunger for constant stimulation that it's not enough just to know something happened, but to know what happened after it happened, to constantly be updated, to feel like somehow we are more relevant by virtue of being forever in an unfolding now. If this is getting a little too navel-gazy, we'll take a break in a minute. Jeff from Hill Hole, Indiana says, same thing happened with the Indianapolis Star here. It was a great newspaper for over 100 years. Then Gannett bought it in 2002, and it's been a worthless right-wing rag ever since. Control the media, you control the people. Control the people, you control the country. Control the country, you do pretty well, anything you want. Todd, you didn't send me the picture, but I want to see the picture. Yeah, that was there too. Steve from Georgia Stan pointing out, Ted Turner also masterminded starting shows 5 minutes after the hour so that if people were channel surfing, they'd land on his channel and there would actually be programming taking place. Mm-hmm. So I guess at 23 minutes before the hour, before the second hour of the program, no, before the third hour of the program. Whoa. I've filibobstered a half a program away. I hope y'all didn't mind. I like talking and thinking about things like this because it's perspective. That helps us to understand the madness that swirls around us. Arthur, meanwhile, because this does tend to provoke thought, Arthur says, I suspect it's more of a generational thing. I never was much of a newspaper reader. I graduated Vagina U in 1979. I take it that's your year of birth. Not much of a reader in general, but I'm smart, not like everybody says. I'm dumb. I'm smart. I have a feeling, Arthur, that nobody says you're dumb. But that's a nice take on the guy running the country who damned well is. Is it okay that we don't necessarily talk about here what everybody else is talking about? Is it okay if we sort of take those little off ramps that might make what everybody else is talking about make a little bit more sense? I hope so. Because I can't stand the idea of just constantly rehashing what has already been talked right into the ground in the hours preceding this program. So this is the part of the program we call Conversation Radio. Did anything that I brought up tickle a brain cell? Did it motivate you to want to take one of these threads and pull it and run with it and see where it goes? Well, if it did, we got a couple of ways to reach the program. One, a phone number, area code 304-574-8178, or two, Skype. Skype to Skype from anywhere on planet Earth, Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn, Bob Kincaid Horn. And either of those reach, it's one or the other. It can't do both at the same time. But that's how you get into the program if you want to. And I look forward to it if you have such an inclination. Let's do take a break, because filibobstering for an hour and 41 minutes does impose certain limitations. And we'll be back. Okie doke. This is The Horn. This is Conversation Radio. Listener supported. I'm Bob Kincaid. We'll be right back. Okay, about 14 minutes before the hour. Need a little break there. That's okay. This is what passes for Moran Monday on the horn. And going to the phones just in a second here. Punky with a note said, television news once had so much promise. I recall one of Edward R. Murrow's producers referring to it as wielding an electronic pad and pencil. I began to know that it would fall far short of its potential when some forgotten TV station somewhere adopted this slogan for its news effort. If it's news to you, it's news to us. Yeah, that's what passes for a clue, Scott. It is. It is. Okay, let's run over to the phones and see who we've got. Hey, welcome to the program.
Boo.
Yeah, what's up, Jim?
Good evening. How you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
It's okay. It could be better. It could be worse. What can I say?
Yeah, I'm pretty bummed out about the Gazette.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that, because that was one of the key papers in this state that had any type of decent slant on things. You know, this state has changed so much in the past 20 years. My God.
Well, you know, I find it ironic, and not in a good way. I find it ironic, Jim, that this announcement of the bankruptcy comes literally within 2 weeks of the death of Dr. Paul Nyden, who was a brilliant voice for the downtrodden, for working people, and whose work appeared on the pages of the Gazette.
What possibly have to do with it?
He was retired and everything, but it felt somehow connected.
I'm sure it was, Bob.
I don't see how it could be.
I think it could be, you know, just in a way that we don't understand.
I mean, he didn't know what was coming. He was sick, and at the risk of negating what I said a little bit ago, I think it was just an unhappy coincidence.
There are plenty of those, let me tell you. Plenty. Absolutely. I was just listening to your opening remarks about your previous experiences, and I want to ask you something. If you could have done something else, if you had wanted to stay in CNN, what would you have liked to have done?
I could have stayed there if I wanted to. It's not like I was fired.
No, no, no. I mean, what else would you have liked to have done? On air, stuff like that?
Everything. I loved what I was doing at CNN. I looked at trying to get into one of the international bureaus.
Oh, I see.
I wanted to experience the world. But there were things that complicated it. There were
personal life, I'm sure.
Yeah, precisely. Well put. Yeah. And that was an issue. And also after doing, you know, I mean, journalism and DJing was pretty much, apart from the academic, my academic pursuits, college, was pretty much what I had done from the moment I had my first regular job. Interestingly, you know, I learned to write along the way too. But I was working in electronic media, which is what makes and still do, and which is what makes my sense of the sadness at the demise of print somewhat ironic in its own right. But I recognize its value. But by the time, you know, by the time the late 80s were rolling in, I was also having, there was this, if you're serious about that craft, then you're supposed to objectively report the facts, and you're not supposed to inject your personal opinions into them. And I tried very hard to make sure that I kept my opinions out of it. But I was still, you know, very much a liberal or whatever we called ourselves back then. You know, God knows the Republicans were calling us liberals. And so I decided that I wanted to go back to school for something. And so that was why I left CNN, to go back to school.
Okay.
Because I think above all things, I've always loved learning the most, learning anything.
I'm sorry?
I've loved learning more than anything else.
Oh, I thought you said burning.
No, learning. I mean, I was limited. I was never going to be an engineer or anything that involved me to do anything more mathematically complicated than cipher, basic ciphering. But you know, there was still a world out there.
You know, we all reach these watershed dates in our lives when we have to make decisions based on numbers of things. And I went through that too. I mean, I at one time was a dedicated teacher and really loved it. And then it got to the point where it was just so constricted and there were so many other things added to a teaching position. I mean, I could have gone into a junior college or something like that. But I just was so tired of trying to teach. You just burn out.
Well, because so many instances, Jim, the thing you want to do is not the thing you get to do. I mean there are teachers in our community. And they'll tell you that, you know, leave me alone to teach, and I'd love to teach.
There you go.
But it's not teaching. It's teaching and paperwork and bureaucracy and blah, 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 blah. But the same thing happens in so many callings.
Other additionals as defined.
Leave me alone to do what I'm good at, and I won't just be good. I'll be awesome. And I don't mean me, but if you pile a bunch of administrative horse shit on top of it, suddenly it's not so awesome anymore.
No, it's not. And you wonder about these administrators who make much more money than you do. Why in the hell did they not assume some of that responsibility and task and tasking? But what they do, they will periodically hold these meetings to show you that they are doing something, which is nothing more than an in-service workshop or whatever, and they throw the load back on you because part of the in-service delivery is we are adding additional duties to your position.
Right, and it occurs in a broad range. Perhaps it's universal. And for instance, the difference between someone like I mentioned Turner, or his polar opposite, Trump. I mean, the difference between those two men is, and you know, they're 10 years apart in age. The difference between those two men is night and day. But the thing they have in common is that they are able to afford to have people who will deal with the annoying horseshit while they go about the business of being who or whatever it is that they think they are.
By the way, do you know where he sent his two sons to college?
Who, Trump?
No, Turner.
I presume, let me guess, the Citadel?
Exactly.
Because Turner went to Brown, and he got one of the finest classical educations that's available in this country.
Sure did. But, you know, as for me, I just got, since my background was mainly in history, and then I had additional courses in educational administrations. And I didn't make a whole lot of money teaching. I started out testing recruits at Fort Jackson. And the guy who was running the program realized I wasn't happy teaching. He said, "You ever thought about us?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I think so." And that was the turning point in my life. When I said, I can't take the classroom anymore. The classroom isn't the problem. It's the people who try to run it who aren't equipped to run it because they've never really had experience in doing it. Those educational administrators in the public schools, if you put them in a public classroom to teach a class, they would be flying out the door in 5 minutes screaming for help.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely overmatched and under-equipped. And look, I mean, in a military situation, even a chaplain has a chaplain's clerk.
Exactly.
The person who deals with the bullshit that goes with being a chaplain, so the chaplain can go out and chaplain.
Right. Well, you know, these people who are in the administrative end of public education, as I do it, they didn't have the ability to, number one, administrate. They had to have a secretary do their paperwork for them. And number two, they just walk around and, you know, assign duties and make other teachers' lives as miserable as they possibly could.
Yeah, sure.
That's exactly it. And if you put one of them in a classroom, they couldn't handle it. They just could not handle it.
I always think of Samuel Taylor Coleridge, Jim. You know, there's that brilliant poet of the romantics of the late 18th, early 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he had a horrible laudanum habit. A lot of people did back then. But he tells that story, and maybe it was just an excuse for why he couldn't finish the poem. But he told that story of having seen in an opium dream no less than, I don't know how many lines, lots of lines of poetry, all just written out in front of him, and he woke up and he started writing, and it was the fragment known as Kubla Khan.
Uh-huh.
And then the person from Porlock came to knock on his door and pester him about his tailoring bill, and by the time he got back, what he had seen in his vision was gone.
And there was his stately pleasure dome decree.
Right. No pleasure dome for you, Samuel Taylor Coleridge.
Yep.
But that person, you know, that phrase, the person from Porlock, has come down to us as shorthand for the maddening, trivial bullshit that anybody trying to accomplish something has to put up with before they can ever even go about the business of doing their art.
Unfortunately, that's just the very way it is, unless you are well-funded and in a particular position in which all of those things should be taken care of, and you are allowed to do the best in what you are really trained, and talented to do.
Right.
I mean, you can train anybody to do anything, almost. But as far as innate talent is concerned, that's something you're born with. And some people have it, and some people just have it, they don't have it.
And you know, we have a habit of defining talent as something artistic. And
it's artistic.
But it's not always. There is a talent for dealing with mechanical things. A talent I do not have in any degree. There's a genius, and that word comes down to us from the classics, and it doesn't mean what we apply to it today. But there's a genius for making an organization run, and a lot of people with other talents can't do that. You know, there's the old aphorism that God let the Scots invent whiskey to prevent them from ever ruling the world. And that's
okay.
and that's a manifestation of that as well.
I see. Listen, speaking of mechanical, let me ask you a question. I have a brand new computer. I've not even opened. Well, I have opened it. I had it reprogram certain things for you and other things. But it's got this big three-prong thing on it. And I cannot find an adapter that will put those three prongs into a plug that I can put it into.
Wait, are you talking about the power cord?
Yeah. I can't find an adapter. It goes the other way.
Is it a laptop or a desktop?
A laptop.
And it didn't come to you with the power brick?
Well, I call it the power adapter.
Well,
I have the power brick, but you see, the power adapter has this huge, narrow, three-prong cord. Now, it's hard to find a power adapter that will fit into that thing.
But Jim, you bought it brand new, right?
Yeah.
Okay, it should have come with that.
Then
that's a mistake. I'll bet you if you look at the packing list on it, it'll show. Because there's the adapter and there's the plug that goes into the computer. And on the other end of that, there's a cord that goes from the adapter brick over
into
the
power. Wall.
Right. And you're talking about the line that goes from the adapter into the wall, right?
Yeah, I am. And it didn't come with it. So, I mean,
well,
you know,
check your materials packing list. Because the first page of your owner's manual will say, inside this box is the following.
Well, okay. I've gone there, it's not there, and it's just real strange because,
Well, who's the manufacturer?
Hewlett-Packard. But nonetheless, you know, the reason I haven't, I've allowed myself just to put this off to another time because I've had a lot of other problems, believe you me, is, excuse me. My old Sony Vaio that was on Windows 7, and this new computer has Windows 10, and I despise Windows 10. I cannot deal with that operating system.
Oh, wait, you know what? I just got a note from Robert in Australia that he says, what you're describing, and I may have had the wrong idea, are you talking about the part that goes into the wall?
Yeah.
So
I don't have any plugs where I can put it in that go into the wall.
Right. You've got a European plug, says Robert.
Precisely.
And that's at least easily remedied. You can get a Euro adapter, Amazon, whatever. But for some reason or another, you were shipped, I don't know where you ordered it, but you were shipped a laptop for use in European outlets.
Uh-huh. Well, I would assume that one of the regular European adapters are available in any store, should they not be?
Around here, that could be pretty specialized. I'd look on BestBuy.com or something like that, or hell,
just look on Amazon,
and it'll be there day after tomorrow.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm gonna have to do, and. It's really strange that they would not include that, and it just really angered me. But as far as Windows 10 is concerned, why in the world did they come up with that operating system?
Well, because the operating system, you know, is what Microsoft does. It's where their money comes from.
Are you running Windows 10?
Yes.
How long did it take you to get used to it?
I pretty much still hate it.
As opposed to Windows 7?
Yeah.
It was somewhat simpler. Enough of that.
Well, but Windows, but then we also had conniptions over Windows 7 when Windows Vista came out, and Vista replaced...
I know. 8.
No, well, Vista replaced 8, but 8 replaced... No, it was 7, then 8, 7, then Vista, then 8, then 10. But XP, Windows XP.
XP was before all of it.
Well, XP worked fine. I loved the way the audio worked. For me, it's a pain in the ass because they keep making the way that Windows handles audio dumber and dumber and dumber.
I still have a desktop I haven't used in 10 years that has Windows XP on it. Of course, I'm not able to use the desktop because of physical problems. But it's a nice computer, and it's really a pity. So I've been dealing with that, but since we were talking about technical stuff and things of that nature, I was just wondering about that because, you know, this is one where you plug the three prong into it and the two prong into your outlet.
Oh, wait, the three prongs are going into the brick?
What do you mean by brick? That term is
the big goddamn transformer.
Yeah.
There's a fixed cable that comes off the transformer, goes into the computer, on the other end, and people just call it a brick, Jim, because it's like a brick. When it plugs directly into the wall, it's called a wall wart.
Thank you.
But the transformer. And it's got a fixed wire that goes into your computer, and the other end has a wire that plugs into it and in turn plugs into the wall. You're telling me the three prongs are what goes into the transformer?
Yes.
Okay, so it's not Euro. That's just that kind of wire. And I go back to my original thesis. It should have come with your unit.
Well, I've looked, and it's not there. The only reason, like I say, I'm going back to it is because, you know what? Because I really love that machine, but, you know, even railroad lines wear out. And right now, I'm talking to you and listening to you through, of all things, what do you call them?
Bluetooth?
Remote, no. It's just, number 5 with Amazon Kindle.
Oh, okay, sure. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, it works. You just put a headphones into it. I mean, I'm not stupid as far as that stuff is concerned.
No, not at all.
This does not make sense to me whatsoever. And so, I would hope that I would could find a convert or an adapter.
No, the fact of the matter is, as Ron points out down in Raleigh, says, tell Jim, go to HP's website, enter the model number into the support search, and then you order the right adapter or power cord from HP. And that way you'll know you're getting exactly what you need.
Oh, God damn.
Well, I mean, that really is the simplest way to go about it.
I couldn't just pick up what store? A regular thing like that, or
well, the store where you would have picked one of those up at, ran themselves into the ground. It was called Radio Shack.
Huh. Well, as the Englishman said when he dropped his friend out of a plane with a parachute that didn't open, and he picked him up, and he looked, and he said, homosexual? And he said, no. And the other guy said, pity. Oh, Lord have mercy. Oh, God. I was changing away from that. Yeah, you know, it was a... Now, I asked this friend of mine, he said, oh, hell, just get you a pair of his sniffs and cut that big old thing off that cord. Which is probably the simplest way to do it.
Oh, no, don't do that. It's going... No, don't do that. Don't do that.
No, I haven't done that. I said, thank you. Pity.
Yes. But if it's the way I understand it, it's fairly simple. But I'm telling you, if you open page 1 of the owner's manual, there will be a list of what is included with this device. And if that cord will...
I have to reread it again. Like I say, I've heard a lot of other...
It's literally, you know, page 1, page 2, page 3. I mean, what's in the box is what it's usually called. And away you'll go.
Well, I'm going to have to play that old song, Baby Let Me Bang Your Box, and see what we can get out of it, right?
Yeah, just have it, you know, just have a look in there, because... It sounds like a shipping error, because they don't send computers with power adapters that don't have the it's just the lone cord. It's not the brick. It's not that. It's just a lone cord that goes from the brick to the wall. They do not ship laptops that don't have those in them.
Where do they get these names? A power adapter, brick, and all this stuff. The nomenclature is ridiculous.
Well, I mean, does it not look like a brick to you? Rectangular?
No.
Thick? I mean, you know.
It's like a power adapter to me. I just don't have that much imagination, I guess. I mean, when you talk about bricks, I'm thinking about things in Egypt. I'm sorry. It's just my mindset.
It's metaphor.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Nonetheless, we just went through some reminders of the Holocaust, and there are a lot of things appearing on Facebook about this. And I think yesterday was one of the anniversaries of Auschwitz-Birkenau, the liberation.
Yeah.
And I pulled out an HBO special, a DVD I had when it first came out, called Conspiracy, with Kenneth Branagh and Stanley Tucci.
Oh, no, I've watched that. I watched that a year or so ago, and it was breathtaking.
Well, when I saw that, it was a couple of years ago, and my printer was working.
I think I watched it on your recommendation, as a matter of fact.
I did. I remember that. As a matter of fact, we were talking about CNN, and you asked me what was the first thing CNN put out, and I told you about it was, I was the one who put out the thing about the girl being in the well. Remember?
Yeah.
But anyway, so what I did, I went to the internet, and I printed out at least 7 copies of the minutes of that meeting at Bonsai. And I had 7 individual DVDs. And I mailed them to people. And, you know, I didn't get a whole lot of response from it.
Not surprised.
Well, I never heard about this. Well, that's not what they said. And there was one who was so anti-Semitic who even mentioned the fact that he just didn't have a whole lot of compassion for that type of thing.
Breathtaking, but it's a very real phenomenon. Of course, the Vice President of the United States, ragingly...
God, what is he up to now?
Oh, an absolute raging asshole evangelical, but you know that. He delivered an address at Yad Vashem, and you know what Yad Vashem is?
Of course I do, yes.
And then he put up a tweet on Holocaust Remembrance Day. A few days ago, he tweeted, Karen and I, at least he didn't refer to her in the tweet as mother, as he does around the house. A few days ago, Karen and I paid our respects at Yad Vashem to honor the 6 million Jewish martyrs of the Holocaust who, 3 years after walking beneath the shadow of death, rose up from the ashes to resurrect themselves to reclaim a Jewish future.
Okay.
You heard every word I read, right?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I'm listening carefully.
It's nauseating. The guy loaded up what is ostensibly a tweet offering remembrance and condolence for the horrors of the Holocaust. He loaded it up with millennialist Christian...
supporting Donald Trump.
No. He loaded it up with millennialist Christian eschatology. First, referring to the Jewish martyrs of the Holocaust. Well, mm-hmm. It's not really a martyrdom situation. It's not like the Nazis rounded up milkmaids for Maimonides. Okay?
I understand that. You can't be a martyr in the Christian faith just by being a victim of the Holocaust. There's no way that can happen.
They weren't murdered for their faith. They were murdered for their Jewishness.
Exactly. And they were murdered for their ethnic backgrounds.
Hitler killed secular atheist Jews with as much verve as he did the most hardcore Orthodox.
Oh, yeah. You just have to have spit girls be killed by Hitler. That's for sure.
So then, and again, you know, Christians might look at this and go, well, okay. But you don't take a bunch of Christian allegory and cram it into a tweet about Holocaust remembrance. Get this, Jim, get this. 3 years after walking beneath the shadow of death, rose up from the ashes to resurrect themselves to reclaim a Jewish future. 3 years, 3 days, rose up, resurrected. He Jesusified every Jew on earth.
Well, that doesn't surprise me. Doesn't shock me at all. Not at all.
Well, it's not shocking because he's Mike Pence.
You know, I don't but it's offensive. That man is.
It's
really
offensive. I mean, I'm not Jewish and I'm offended. I'm offended for my Jewish friends.
Well,
I mean,
have you talked to them about it?
If Twitter allowed more than 280 characters, there would have been a fucking altar call, Jim.
Well, I don't know. I don't know. It just depends on. I mean, I wonder if Jerry Kushner was offended.
Well, you know, they make a big deal out of him being Orthodox Jewish. I get the sense that he's about as Orthodox Jewish as I am. Okay.
Well, of course he's not Orthodox. He's Reformed or whatever they
call it. No. He's Orthodox.
Well, why does he have the spit curls and all this
stuff? There's
stuff.
A difference between Orthodox and Hasidim.
Okay. So instead of running a thrift shop, he's going to be running a big business, right?
Well, I mean, yeah,
I mean, Hasidic Jews are known for the thrift shops. They're the best in New York City.
I'd had no idea.
God, yes.
But I always thought, you know, there's, and then of course the diamond guys, the diamond cutters, and the diamond merchants.
Well, each has his own specialty of a way of making a living.
But they're not particularly good at it. I wouldn't be surprised to catch, say, Jared and Ivanka trying to sneak off the interstate at a barbecue joint sometime and just sitting down to a big old pulled pork big sandwich.
Well, why not?
Because they're Orthodox.
I mean, to me, that would be easy. It just
would
be
easy. But it does to the Orthodox, believe me.
I know. But to me, it means nothing. And, you know, I respect that. If they don't want to eat pork, that's fine.
Right. But the thing is, for instance, and this was the thing, do you know who Chef Jose Andres is?
No, sir.
He is a world-renowned Spanish chef who came to the United States and turned the restaurant world on its ear. And he runs a number of fusion-based restaurants, for instance, where he will marry Peruvian cuisine with Cantonese. Or something like that, and what results is nothing short of mind-bendingly delicious.
Well, that's absolutely marvelous. I mean, who would have thought?
And he's got several restaurants in Washington D.C. And back when Trump was looking for somebody to put a signature restaurant inside the old post office there that he was opening up for as a hotel, where, by the way, bookings are way the hell down and the room rates are way the hell up. Just a fact.
Now, where is this? Oh, the old Jagged Tooth?
Yeah, right there at, what, 9th and Pennsylvania or 11th
and
Pennsylvania?
Yeah, that's what they call it, the old Jagged Tooth.
Yeah, well, that's where the Trump Hotel is. And Jose Andres was going to put in the restaurant there and, in fact, had cut a deal with him. And then, because Trump is a goddamn dumbass, he announces his candidacy by coming down an escalator and talking about Mexican rapists. And Jose Andres immediately said, yeah, you know what? I can't do business with you. You're just nasty. And so there was the Trump organization sued Jose Andres. Jose Andres counterclaimed, and you know how Trump's always saying, yeah, I'm going to sue him. I'll bankrupt him. I'll destroy him.
Yeah.
Well, they settled that suit quietly with, apparently, Chef Andres didn't have to write a great big money check to the Trump organization. And so he's absolutely the king of cuisine in D.C. But on top of that, when Maria hit Puerto Rico, as Trump said, and also Puerto Rico. God, what a fucking dummy. When Maria hit Puerto Rico, Jose Andres said, screw it all, got on a plane, and went down to Puerto Rico and fed more people down there on a daily basis than FEMA and the Red Cross combined.
I saw that on the news. I certainly did.
That man is entitled to some sort of award, some sort of medal. He is a patriot in his adopted country. He is a patriot of the first order.
And if you think this administration would have given him that order, or that award,
it made them
look like absolute shit.
So we're not even done with the story. This is all what's passed as prologue. So this past Saturday, I think it was Friday. There's some sort of soiree that means something to the somebodies who walk around breathing the rarefied oxygen in D.C. called the Alfalfa Dinner. Do you have any idea what that is? I mean, you know.
It's probably with your acumen.
No, because I don't. It's this big hoity-toity, highfalutin dinner where people come out and, I don't know, they applaud for each other or something. But the Alfalfa Dinner was held, and then there was an after party at Cafe Milano in D.C.
I know about that.
Milano in D.C., and it was listed as all are welcome. Everybody who attended the Alfalfa Dinner was welcome to come to the after party at Cafe Milano.
Wow. Must have been nice, because I was in D.C. I was just a lowly GS-12, Step 8. And, you know, I couldn't afford stuff like that.
Well, but remember, here's the operative phrase, all are welcome. So Jose Andres was at the Alfalfa Dinner. Maybe it's got something to do with the restaurant industry or something. I don't know. But Cafe Milano is apparently home base for the swells of the Trumpanzees. The people who rub elbows with his orange eminence itself.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's known as being, you know, supposedly a fancy schmancy Italian joint there. I think it's somewhere around DuPont Circle. And so
all
all are welcome at the Alfalfa Dinner after party at Cafe Milano, where they serve a lot of pig. And they're famous for their calamari risotto dish, shellfish, not kosher. And
although,
Precious Ivanka shows up because she was at the alfalfa dinner, and then Chef Jose Andres shows up, and he has been a vocal critic of the Trump administration, and of course he made her sweat because supposedly she and Junior and the other one are running the Trump Hotel, and you know Donald isn't, and he held her feet to the fire in that lawsuit.
And she asked somebody to leave or pull some kind of stuff.
Well, she pulled the owner of Cafe Milano aside and said, "I'm uncomfortable with Jose Andres being here." Okay, so the Alfalfa Dinner is a social club that exists, according to Wikipedia, only to hold an annual black tie banquet on the last Saturday of January at the Capitol Hilton in Washington, D.C., with an after party at a local restaurant. The Marine Band plays. There's a political roast. There are approximately 200 members of the club, all of whom are influential politicians and business executives, and blah, blah, blah. It's named the Alfalfa Club over a joking reference to the fact that alfalfa, the plant, will do anything for a drink.
Okay.
It's water thirsty.
Understood.
So Ivanka gets there, and Chef Jose Andres shows up, and she pulls the proprietor aside and says, "I don't feel comfortable with Jose Andres here."
Oh, yeah.
And so the owner calls him outside and says, "You know, listen, old egg, you know," only he's Italian. And then, having pulled him outside, they won't let him back in. I mean, it was cheap and sleazy and tawdry.
I read this. I heard this. I saw this. Yes, I know what you're talking
about. And who knew? Who knew that a snowflake could be made out of silicone? But that's my new name for Ivanka, the silicone snowflake.
Well, he's got a new name, too. Bloatus.
Yeah, well, that, too, yes.
God
but
damn.
But you know what a pathetic display of their manifest insecurity, and it has blown back on them like crazy, to the point that the owner of Cafe Milano was tweeting for all he was worth last night saying it was a total misunderstanding. Ivanka didn't say that.
She did.
Yes, she did. And you go over and look on Yelp and the one-star reviews of Cafe Milano, which was once a respected restaurant in D.C., are hilarious. And so, you know, the people who go to places like Cafe Milano, D.C. is not a Trump town. It's not full of people who love Trump. There aren't enough maggots in D.C. to keep Cafe Milano afloat.
No, you've got the K-12s in D.C., and you've got other people who are not Trumpazes. But, you know, the cave dwellers, the people who live on Calarama, in that section of the city, they're not really supporting of anybody. They are residents. The rest are tenants.
And so, you know, I got a feeling it's not going to go. He'll be a while living that down. But it was a loathsome piece of business, and that's the other thing. It got me to thinking. I've come up with a new word for the entire Trump family, Jim.
I can imagine.
Not even dirty.
That's okay.
But you know, they're this weird looking, inbred looking bunch of freaks. Who you know, nobody in New York likes them. They're tolerated.
Oh my God! They beat everybody in New York out of every fit they can.
And they're tolerated because of what money and influence they have, but they're not liked. God knows the city of New York just buried him in the presidential election. And they don't like, and you know, the old money in New York doesn't like him because they're just jumped up. They're a bunch of slumlords from Jamaica, Queens.
Parvenu.
I don't think they even deserve that, because that sounds a little bit fancy in French. You know,
in French, it has quite a different meaning. It's not a nice phrase to know.
Yeah,
that.
I know, but when you say refrigerator in French to people who speak English, refrigerator sounds sexy. Le frigo.
Okay.
But they're just a bunch of jumped up slumlords, and you know, Trump's granddaddy was a fucking pimp. It's undeniable. He ran brothels, and he was deported from Germany because he's a coward.
He didn't fight the First World War.
No, I think he ran out on the Franco-Prussian War.
Was that it? 1870? He was fighting that one?
Yeah. And then he tried to come back because his wife was missing Bavaria, and they said, "Nah, fuck you, no. You go back to America, and so we can blame the Germans for that too."
Hell yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely.
We got the Germans to blame for the Trumps, and we got the Russians to blame for Ayn Rand. I'm putting together a list.
I know you got it.
But he was a pimp. His sainted mother she didn't have any skills. They want skills-based immigration. Mary didn't have any skills. She came from an inbred bunch that walked through quicksand. No, that walked through quicksand just to try to get to church because the rich people looked down their noses at them. That's how poor, shitty, and miserable they were on that little island where they lived, where she lived, where the gene pool was so shallow you couldn't drown a piss ant in it. But New York and they recognize them for the trash that they are.
Now hold on, what did you just refer to? I'm not clear. They live on some little island.
Yeah, she.
Or it's a quicksand.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Yeah, yeah. She lived on a little tiny Scottish island that was rapidly depopulated and had very few people on it.
Right.
I mean, by the time she immigrated, she came from a family that it was lucky she wasn't born with a third ear growing out between her eyes. I mean, I don't know if the Scottish have banjos, but you know, banjo music.
The reason I ask is because you know there are a number of these little islands off the coast of Scotland in which they have like very unique social situations. Do you know what I'm saying?
You're going to have to be a little bit more explicit.
Well, they are removed from the mainland of Scotland.
Yes.
And they live on these little islands. They have their own customs. They have their own traditions. And they are supplied by ferry, by water. And they, in turn, have their own internal industries.
Right. But these little tiny islands, for instance, this little community, I can't remember which island, not going to look it up. Very few people on it, and nobody owned land because after the enclosures, no actual Scots people who weren't filthy rich were allowed to own land. So they were just, you know, they were just tenants literally mucking it out of the quicksand.
Well, they had a lord there, a laird, who in those islands, the way I understand it, who owned the whole island. Now, on this particular island, I saw this on PBS, they had a rebellion in which they had to come to an agreement with the lord of the laird, in which he would give them their land, and he would in turn keep his, and I guess to some arrangement would each person be served in the best manner possible. In other words, this lord owned everything.
Right, and they were, and the family that she came from was just dirt ass poor, and that's why she immigrated.
Okay. I did not understand.
He describes it as she came on a vacation over here and met my father on vacation. It wasn't no fucking vacation. She couldn't afford a vacation. She emigrated hoping to do better than she was going to do on that island. Since I understand the history of immigration, for instance, to Appalachia, and we get called hillbillies, and we're mostly Scots-Irish with a smattering of Germans and African Americans, and a little bit of people of indigenous extraction in the bloodlines, and what, but mostly Scots-Irish.
Right.
And we're referred to as hillbillies. And it comes with a tremendous negative connotation. Well, I have come up with a word to describe the Trump families of Jamaica, Queens. Jim,
hey.
Jim, they are burrowbillies.
Burrowbillies. Okay. Well...
The Burrowbillies of Jamaica, Queens.
God, Bob, the only thing I've ever heard that really came out of, really good out of Jamaica, Queens, at one time, it was the size of the 1939 World Fair. That's about it.
And Trump's mama probably went to that with Fred. That was what year, the 39?
My mother went to it. I have a lot.
Well, that would be 12. That would be.
I collect stuff from that fair.
That would be 12 years after Trump's pappy was busted at a Klan riot in the aforesaid Jamaica, Queens, railing against the Catholics in the police force.
Hey, listen, let me ask you something. Have you ever looked into that fair and some of the stuff that was in it?
Yeah, I have.
It is incredible. The World of Tomorrow. The Trilogue, the Paris Fair. Because my mom went to it as a, she and my dad had just gotten married, or, no, they weren't even, yeah, they were married. And he didn't, but she did with her mother. And it was just incredible. They even, at that fair, had some type of primitive ATM.
Yeah, there was a lot of stuff at that World's Fair. And it's kind of bittersweet because it all went to shit and the World of Tomorrow turned into an abattoir.
It sure did. But, I mean, you know, to see the films of it and to see the documentaries made about it, and I don't want to get too far into that, but it was, and to have known someone who went to it and he could describe things about it to you and then you could pass on things to you about it. And the one thing about that World's Fair, and I have a collection of these things, they are World's Fair plates, okay? And they have the whole imprimatur of the World's Fair, and guess who made those plates?
The folks here in West Virginia?
Homer Laughlin. You can't get one for less than $300 a piece.
Wow.
And they are absolutely beautiful.
Well, Jim, it has been a magnificent conversation.
Excuse me, if you indulge me.
Yeah.
I've got one more thing to add. And I was watching this thing on American History Channel. They have found a way that through lip reading, that they can film a person who is lip reading, and as long as they have a recording of them in normal conversation, they can reproduce what the person was saying.
Yeah, they did that with Hitler, didn't they?
Precisely. They did it with Hitler when he went to see Mannerheim in June of 1942. And it was done by mistake. They just left a big mic right in front of him, and Hitler was speaking in a normal voice. Well, they now have machines that can do it, you know, from the front, the side. It's just amazing. And they took Ava Braun's home movies and Hitler in private conversation speaking in a normal voice, not that Mad Dog style that he always used. And there was one thing that I remember that they recorded that he said about Hermann Göring, you know, the Reichsmaster of the Hunt.
Yeah.
Hitler said, well, only pigs who hunt pigs will eat pigs.
What a bunch. What about
he didn't have a whole lot of use for Herman, that's for sure.
Well, I had never seen Inglourious Basterds, and I watched that over the weekend.
Well, anyway, it's
amazing. It had its cute moments, but I thought it was a bit overly long.
But it is amazing how they can actually reproduce speech, as long as you have a recording of a person speaking in a normal voice. It's just they have specialists in this.
Yeah.
And so I just found it absolutely fascinating. And particularly his remarks about Herman. One more thing. Our beloved president, has he done anything crazy today?
All the other shows will be full of the fact that they have driven Andrew McCabe out of his position at the FBI. They couldn't get Rosenstein, and they couldn't get they can't get Mueller, so they have driven the Trump administration has forced out Andrew McCabe on this on the pretext of this absolutely specious bullshit memo somebody in Devin Nunez's office wrote, based on classified information that they should probably have never been allowed to see.
Well, Trump has set a date to talk with Mueller, correct?
I don't know that the date has been set.
A couple weeks. Now.
But they've got to be having kittens with crocheted tails at the idea of it.
Well, is Trump going to come to see, as long as I can speak with you with my lawyer?
Well, one of the things, you know, they've been asking for... Well, we'd like a list of printed questions that you plan to ask. Mueller has apparently said, yeah, no, that's not going to happen.
It shouldn't happen. It should be extemporaneous. As much as you can get him to speak extemporaneously and also speak the truth.
Well, to the extent that it's a search for the truth, having canned answers is antithetical toward that inquiry.
Of course it is. Of course it is. Of course it is. Goddamn, man, how much longer we have to put up that son of a bitch? Bob, do you think that they can really get him out of there?
I would not go and put my last dollar bill on it at a betting parlor.
No, I wouldn't either. I think we're just going to have to put up with him as long as he's there.
I'm not saying it can't happen. I'm not saying it won't happen. I'm saying that it's highly unlikely, because the first part.
We're talking about probability.
Yeah, the first part of it is getting rid of this godforsaken Republican majority in the House and Senate, and that's going to require a massive mobilization of voters, sufficient to overcome the gerrymandering in the House districts and the voter suppression in both the House districts and the Senate races.
And on top of it,
Jim, it's going to require a certain amount of political acumen on this side of the ideological divide, wherein people say, "Listen, we've just got to get rid of that guy. If there's an old yeller dog vote running, vote for the old yeller dog."
I understand that. But either, you know, if they could impeach Trump, who would we get? Pence.
That's not part of my calculus, Jim.
Well,
I'm not worried when you've got, and I'm not trying to be crass or anything, but when you've got a bad dose of the clap, you have to get rid of the clap, and you don't say, well, is it worth getting rid of the clap? Because I think I've also got a case of athlete's foot.
I've had the clap, believe you me. If worth getting rid of.
But you get my point.
I do.
You can't worry about what Pence is. This is a constitutional crisis, and we have to do what the Constitution requires. Now, if the coin was flipped, for instance, one of the things that protected W against impeachment was the fact that Cheney was there. If Pence was president and Trump was vice president, you would never hear the word impeachment uttered. Mm-hmm. But that ain't how it is. Anyway, Jim, I got to try to let a couple more calls in here, or at least one, if I can. You have yourself a wonderful evening. I hope you get your transformer issue sorted out.
Well, thanks for the advice. I appreciate the input.
All right, go look at that packing list, or look at the list inside the owner's manual. Do that first.
For the fifth time, I will.
All right, you do that. Later, Jim.
Out here.
That's our buddy Jim, and. We have some pretty good conversations. That whole Jose Andres thing was just embarrassing. But then again, that's what the Burrow Billies do to us. They embarrass us. There is a phrase, and it is freighted, and it is bigoted. But there's a phrase that exists in the South, primarily. And that phrase is poor white trash. Okay? Well, the poor part of poor white trash doesn't necessarily have to refer to one's economic status. And the fact that trash is on the end of that three-word phrase extends the idea that the poor part, in fact, yeah, traditionally it referred to an economic status, but it also refers to a poverty of intellect and a poverty of decency and a poverty of ability to engage in common civil conduct, a poverty of curiosity, a poverty of decency. And with that as a working definition, there is no better example of poor white trash than the Burrow Billies, the Trump family. And I just got a note from Steve from Georgistan about the House voting on the memo release. They are trying to discredit Mueller's investigation because of the truth it contains. All that memo horseshit, that manufactured stuff about FBI bias, you know what? If there was nothing to hide and if there weren't a shit ton of people in both Congress and the executive branch who had exposure in it, they wouldn't be doing that. They would simply let Mueller go about his work and do his job and then sit back and say, well, okay. But instead, they know they're exposed up to their eyebrows. And in point of fact, it has just come out, thanks Robert in Morgantown, it has just come out that the Trump administration has declared that it will decline to impose sanctions against companies and foreign countries doing business with blacklisted Russian defense and intelligence entities. Congress passed a law in 2016 meant to punish Russia for what it did in the U.S. election. And a State Department spokesman said today that the Trump administration had decided to put foreign governments and private sector entities on notice that significant transactions with listed Russian entities will result in sanctions. Sanctions on specific entities or individuals will not need to be imposed because the legislation is in fact serving as a deterrent. Bullshit. Apparently, somebody told Donnie that if those sanctions went into effect, the PP tape might have to come out. Yep. Hey, Scott.
Hello, Bob.
How are you?
I'm pretty well. Pretty well. Got up to 83 here today. Can you believe that?
Rub it in.
No, the last I heard it was fairly mild where you were.
Oh, it is. It is fairly mild, yeah. But it ain't no 83. And
no, well, if I could send you something,
it was a bearable 50s today. And yeah. You know, this, but we traditionally we have a midwinter thaw. Right now it's snowing in 35 though.
Oh, Jesus.
And it will snow all night and into the morning. Tomorrow's high will be 27, and the low will be 16. Now, what I'm worried about, this, like I said, we call this pneumonia weather because the high on Wednesday will be 51 with a low of 37. It'll be 19 tonight. I'll be putting on a bottle of gas. Haven't had to do that a lot lately, and that's a good thing. I'm wondering about Wednesday. Because Wednesday we get the super blue moon lunar eclipse. The last time that happened was 152 years ago. And it's happening, by God, on my birthday. So I'm hoping I've got skies clear enough to see the super blue moon lunar eclipse.
Yeah. Jeez.
Might even have to hook up the head-worn microphone and walk outside with a coat on and broadcast that way for a little bit just to see the moon as it comes up.
Well, you talked about a lot of things with Jim, and I tend to think that the thing that Jim is lacking with his computer cord, power cord, it sounds to me like it's one of those three-prong adapters on those grounded electrical plugs.
No. But he explained to me it's the part of the wire that goes into the brick. Now we're not gonna have a problem using the word brick, are we?
No, because I'm looking at my brick right now as we speak.
Okay, so let me look at mine too.
I can't quite reach it, but I see it from here.
My brick also has a three-prong adapter that goes into, you know, a standard so-called 110. Now Sparky will tell me it's really 120. But a standard 110, you know, US plug. It's the part that goes into the brick, if I understand Jim correctly. And those are kind of weird because and it's sort of triangular. They're all there together. And they all... And that's the problem. But as Ron and Raleigh pointed out, it would not be the first, nor will it be the last, that one of those things has shipped without all the appropriate cords.
Well, when I got this Mac, it's called a MacBook Air, and I got it a couple of years ago, secondhand. It was a used computer, but it was refurbished and everything. And the power cord, you can take off part of the thing that's on one end of the brick, okay, and plug in like a foot and a half long extension power cord, and that has the three-prong grounded thing on it. But I think I understand now what's missing. On Jim's, but yeah, he needs to check.
Yeah, it's the cord that goes from the brick to the wall,
and that's the part that's missing.
Yes.
Okay. All right. That makes sense.
Because transformers are two-part affairs. By the way, Earther just said, "Oh, great! This has devolved into a brick measuring contest." That's the first cowbell of the evening right there. That's what that is.
Yes.
Brick measuring content. Yo. Arthur stays on top of his games.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope he can find whatever it is that he's looking for. I would think that Best Buy, or is he anywhere near a Best Buy?
No, there's not one of those in Beckley.
How about a Walmart? Walmart might have it, or they could, you could order it online and they'll ship it to the store.
Yeah, Amazon's Jim's best bet.
Yeah, if Amazon doesn't have it, you didn't need it.
Right.
But anyway, I liked your discussion about newspapers, and I'm sorry that your local paper has hit upon hard times. I grew up, you know, around D.C., reading the Washington Post and the afternoon paper, the Washington Daily News. But when I was a kid, we had two afternoon papers plus the morning paper. But those days are essentially long gone. And I tried to keep up with newspapers with all the places where I've lived. But after the Kansas City Star, I was in Jefferson City, Missouri, and as I recall, that newspaper was nothing to shout about. And then I was in Corpus Christi, and that newspaper was nothing to shout about. And then I was in Tulsa, and that newspaper was not much to shout about. And the Cincinnati papers were okay. And then I moved out here, and the San Diego Union Tribune, Punky will not even shit on it.
Oh man,
that's what a low.
Well, that's what I said about the Beckley paper. I would not insult carp guts by wrapping them in the Beckley paper.
But I'm telling you, Bob, and at one time, until a couple of years ago, the San Diego paper was owned by this guy named Doug Manchester, who owns a bunch of hotels, right wing to beat the band, and he had back in I guess 2008 had contributed a shit ton of money to the anti-Prop 8 or the pro-Prop 8 thing, you know, the thing, you know, banning gay marriage or I forget now what all it was, but it thankfully is no longer applicable. But that son of a bitch, if they put the weather on the front page, which they often do, I would look outside before I believe what they wrote on their front page, even about the weather. But now, I don't know who the hell owns it, but, and they're a very anti-union paper. They got rid of a lot of their drivers some years ago. So just on those two bases, I have no use for them. And you were, maybe it wasn't you, it was someone talking about that movie, The Post, about the Pentagon Papers. I'm waiting for the movie, and we'll never see it. But several years later, in the mid-70s, when the Post was converting from hot lead technology to camera-ready offset cold-type technology, they screwed their printers union. And it got so ugly there for a while that they couldn't even print the paper at the Washington Post printing plant in downtown D.C. They had to ship the plates or satellite the hard copy to other places. I think West Virginia was one of the other places. And then print the papers there and truck them into D.C. It was horrible. But we'll never see a movie about that because it puts, you know, Ben Bradley and Catherine Graham in a not so nice light.
Well, and to be fair, the Gazette has kind of a shameful past history with regard to its workforce back in the 70s. The Gazette was always very pro-union relative to the UMWA.
Yeah.
But when it came time to deal with its own union, they came down on them like a rock.
Was it the Pressman's Union and the Writers Guild?
I mean, I don't know what the unions were.
Yeah.
But because that's 40 plus years ago.
But it was probably the transition from from hot lead technology to cold type. That was a great advance technologically, but it screwed linotype workers. It screwed, you know, the press people. It screwed a lot of people out of their job situation.
And technology will always do that. But yeah, by the old clock on the wall, we got to get out of here.
Next time I call, I want to pursue this because in my last 2 years of high school, I took 2 years of graphic arts where I learned virtually anything there was to know about graphic arts, printing, photography, layout, design, all that stuff. And my first job was as a printer in a shop that was in a pet supply wholesaler. And we used to do our own catalog and stuff. And that technology has really changed. I mean, and it's not as messy as it used to be with the chemicals and inks and stuff.
Right.
But anyway, that's for another day.
All right. Well, Scott, you and Punky have a good night. And don't put the Union Tribune there in the bottom of the cage.
He refuses to shit on it. I mean, that's how bad that newspaper is.
He's got to be one miserable little. But so what do you have to do? Get an exported copy of the an imported copy of the L.A. Times?
No, actually, we have, and that's the other thing I want to talk to you about, our neighborhood papers, localized newspapers that come out every 2 weeks. There are a couple of those, and they're giveaway papers, and I'll pick them up from the different boxes around town and read them and, recycle those for the bottom of his house.
I keep a copy of the Beckley paper on hand for any time that I need to fire up the barbecue because I've got one of those charcoal starting chimneys.
Yeah.
And the editorial page of the Beckley paper is really good for that.
Yeah, it's so evil it won't burn.
it goes up like flash paper because it's so goddamned evil.
Well, it's good that there is a use for it. Yep. If it's not good enough for bird crap or fish guts, at least you can start your barbecue with it.
There we go. Scott, have a good night.
All right, you too, Bob.
Bye now.
See ya.
Our buddy Scott with the last word. Time to get out of here. Thank you to all of you who keep the program going. Wasn't this fun? I love these kinds of programs. And thank you very kindly to all of you who spare and share and spend your precious finite time engaging in this little conversation. Thank you so very much for being part of my life and allowing me to be some small part of yours. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff. Thank you, Sparky, in the chat room. Thank you very kindly to our news ninjas. Thank you to Brother Deacon Asa for head-on.live, now with one beautiful new photos of West Virginia. Thank you very kindly to John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. And thanks, of course, to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Later, y'all.